WPFW Washington.
Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Edicto, Colombia, here on this Friday, May 9th, 2025. And we are in the middle right now of WPFW's Spring Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective at this time by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. We have a goal at this hour of $500. You can also give us a call at 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to Latino Media Collective when you do so. Because today on the show, we put the spotlight on the Trump administration's use of tattoos as a means to criminalize not only migrants, but how the practice has been used disproportionately on people of color. And so with me on the show today is Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. One of his recent articles in his Substack page is entitled Court Docs, Street Clothes, Tattoos, and Dubious Claims of Gang Affiliation. Arturo Dominguez, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here, Oscar. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is going to be a good one.
Yeah, this will be interesting, if not ridiculous, in a variety of ways, because before we even discuss recent events, namely the Kilmar Abrego Garcia case, which has continued to maintain national headlines on a variety of issues from migration and false claims of gang affiliation. But before we get to all that, you mentioned in our last conversation about an 8-point scoring chart, and I'm using quotation marks here, using tattoos to determine if someone is a gang member. So this is something that you alluded to the last time we had you on the show. And so I think this is something that's worth expanding for this hour, especially as the issue of tattoos has come up in a variety of ridiculous but also serious ways with serious consequences. Can you tell us how this sort of scoring chart, quote unquote, works and the inherent fallacy of such a system? This goes back to something that is ludicrously called the Alien Enemies Act Validation Guide. And again, this is all in quotations here.
Right. So the validation guide is obviously, you know, supposed to be like a set of guidelines for enforcing the Alien Enemies Act towards migrants. And it's really just like a 2-3-page document, right? There's not much to it. And it starts out with first, you know, agents have to determine that the person is 14 years or older, that they're not a citizen, or, and here's what's funny, that they're not a citizen or lawful permanent resident, right? To make sure that they don't have a green card. And keep that in mind. And then that part of the Alien Enemies Act thing is it's specifically for Venezuelans, right? It has to be against a citizen of Venezuela. And the idea is obviously Trump is trying to portray Venezuela as, you know, some coordinated attack on the U.S. with this Tren del Agua gang. But anyway, once you get past those first three questions, basically, that's where the 8-point system comes into play. And for the 8-point system, there could be a lot of factors, but the key ones that they've been using have been the tattoos, right? So for example, if like one of the explanations on here says, if the subject has been convicted of violating any federal or state law, you know, that's worth 10 points. You know, if they're from Venezuela and basically they're a convicted criminal, you know, they're out. That's the first step. But, and there's a lot of other little random things in there that are worth like 2 points here, 2 points there. But the tattoos and the clothing are both worth 4 points each. And you need a minimum 8 points to, you know, issue a deportation order, for ICE to issue a deportation order. And what's going on here is the ICE agents essentially are using gang database tattoos, right? From the police departments all over the country, you know, because everybody has a gang database now. The federal government has them, you know, DEA, things like that. So they're using all these random tattoos. And the thing about it is that people who have studied Tren de Aragua for years noted that they don't operate with tattoos as insignia like a lot of gangs do. Not every gang operates that way. Tren de Aragua is one of those that doesn't operate with these tattoos. So these cops, you know, a lot of these cops, you know, they're crooked. So all it takes is one shady cop to put in some tattoo, like say a Michael Jordan tattoo or a Chicago yes. Bulls hat, into a database and say these are gang related, completely erasing the cultural significance of Michael Jordan, the Chicago Bulls, a Jordan tattoo, the number 23. There's a lot of cultural significances with Michael Jordan across racial and ethnic lines, right? So like there's a lot of white people that love Jordan. Some of them have tattoos. Dudes wear Jordan jerseys all the time, but you don't see white guys getting busted for having a Jordan jersey or a Chicago Bulls hat or wearing all red or wearing all blue. You know, that just doesn't happen to white people. So the thing with these ICE agents is it's basically to their discretion. So if they see somebody with a number 23, right, they might think, okay, this could be a gang tattoo. But then he's wearing a Chicago Bulls hat. So the agent be like, oh, well, that's 2 out of 3, you know, that's 2 right there. It gets you 8 points. I'm going to put you on the plane out of here. So leaving it up to agents' discretion to decide what is and isn't a gang tattoo is why we're caught up in this weird quagmire that we're in, because we all know that the vast majority of ICE agents are racist, right? There's no question about that. Right. And so they're just looking for a reason. And the history here with associating tattoos, I mean, this like really started around 2007 when they started with these gang databases, getting really heavy with them. And, you know, since then, it's the vast majority of people who get taken in for gang affiliation based on tattoos or the gear that they're wearing are non-white people. It's black people and Latinos. Plain and simple, that's what it boils down to. The vast majority are black people and Latinos. So, you know, we're in this situation where this abuse of gang databases and criminalizing people by association, you know, so for example, if I know somebody who was in a gang, you know, and one day cops come to a party and they start questioning people and there's somebody who's in the gang database, next thing you know, everybody at that party's in the gang database. And that could really ruin a lot of people's lives. And when you look at it from such a close-up perspective with immigration, you really see how damaging that could be, especially what we've been seeing the last few months.
Yeah, and thank you for pointing out that this affects Black and Latinos, because while migration has brought us to this conversation, it's quite clear that the politics of tattoos and the criminalization of people with tattoos is at this present point in time directly affecting African-American, Latinos, generally speaking, people of color right now, especially under this administration. And so could you give us a few more absurd examples of how otherwise benign logos have been misinterpreted as gang symbols? Because I've seen your Substack article on this. And like you mentioned before, there's the Michael Jordan logo, the number 23. There's the crown, which sort of ties to a certain degree about the Venezuelan hairdresser who got sent to the Gulag prison in El Salvador. There are various tattoos here that I think are worth mentioning. Also some that weren't included here that I think are worth mentioning as well. The one that caught my attention, and I don't know if you saw this article, was the one of the clock on the arm, because you're using the image that ICE use with regards to determining gang affiliation. And the clock tattoo was actually recognized by a British man who was interviewed by the BBC saying, hey, that's my arm and that's my tattoo. And so I bring this up because how are they getting these images in the first place, let alone the absurd nature in which they're connecting these things to gang affiliation? I mean, a British guy recognized his own arm, his own tattoo in the image, but the images are being tied to Latino immigrants, as you said.
You know, and that's funny because I totally forgot about the British guy. But yeah, there's a lot. There's one where it's like real until the death, right? Until death in Spanish. Hasta la muerte. Real hasta la muerte. That's the name of a reggaeton song, right? That's extremely popular. Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and things like that. So a lot of people have that tattoo. Obviously the crowns, right? That for Latinos, crowns are a big thing. Crowns are a big thing with Black people too. You know, Black people call each other kings. We're all about, you know, los reyes and los reinas, kings and queens, you know. So I've known a lot of people who have crown tattoos. And then there's one that really struck me because I see this on houses everywhere in Texas. There's a star on there that's shaded, right? All on one side. Like it has, you see that with a circle around it on almost, I mean, on at least half the houses in Texas. It's the Lone Star State, you know? So you see the big star on people's houses. I guarantee you all them folks are not Tren del Agua gang members, you know? And then one is a just like a blacked out silhouette of, it looks like it could be an AK-47, right? All of a sudden, that's a gang tattoo. But when a Republican wears an AR-15 pin to Congress after a mass shooting, you know, all of a sudden, that's okay. Yeah. So
yes,
I've been listening to a lot of scholars recently talking about Republican claims of anti-Semitism. And they keep using the word cynical, right? That's what this is. Just like the cynical claims of anti-Semitism, these are cynical claims of people being gang members. You don't hear about the neo-Nazis. You don't hear about, there are plenty of immigrants in this country who have neo-Nazi type beliefs, right? Elon Musk, Sebastian Gorka, who's a part of national security for Trump. You know, there are a lot of people. I did an article recently for Unicorn Riot listing dozens of people in the Trump administration that are either like white nationalists, Christian nationalists, or just flat out racist or neo-Nazi. And there are a lot. And I didn't include the obvious ones like Stephen Miller and Elon Musk because everybody knows those. I focused on people that the public generally wouldn't know. And you don't hear about these people in the news. You know, you don't hear about their affiliation to neo-Nazi gangs, to white nationalist gangs. You know, there's people in the administration that used Proud Boys in failed campaigns. A lot of people that spoke at white nationalist events have been associated with Nazis and nothing, you know. This is the most racist and most anti-Semitic administration since Nixon, easily since Nixon. It's probably worse than Nixon because there's so many anti-Semites in there and affiliated with more gangs and hate groups and so-called think tanks that are listed as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, that you could classify the Trump administration as a gang, you know, as a racist gang. And I think it's just crazy, you know, when you talk about guys like Hegseth and other people who just sport these outright white nationalist type of tattoos and stuff and are associated with stuff, that they just, the standard is higher.
Hold that thought on Pete Hegseth, because we are going to get to him eventually, because that's part of the narrative that's missing with this whole criminalization of migrants under this second Trump administration. And that gives me the opportunity to go back to what I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, that we are in the middle of WPFW's Spring Plates Drive, which gives the opportunity for the audience to make a donation and support the Latino Media Collective WPFW, the Pacifica Network, and in giving us the opportunity to give a platform to more fantastic journalists and reporters like Arturo Dominguez. And so right now is your opportunity to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, because we are having fun with this conversation, but we also want to give the audience a sense of urgency to the issue at hand that we're discussing, because it is more likely people like myself and Arturo, they are going to be the targets of this type of racial profiling. And that's what it is, racial profiling under the guise of tattoos, which, as Arturo mentioned, is a complete farce, completely inaccurate. I mean, you mentioned the DEA and the FBI, Arturo. Honestly, I feel like people who are making these rules up as they go along have been watching one too many episodes of Gangland, which used to be on A&E, which in my opinion was a horrible show, and just criminalized, as I said before, Black and Latino people in this country. And so this is precisely the sort of thing that should compel the audience to support independent media outlets like WPFW. And, you know, right now, this is probably the best segue right now to go into the clip that probably a lot of people have seen in the past week, which is, of course, the big headline this week is President Trump believing that a Photoshop image of Kinmar Abreu Garcia's hand with the letters MS13 clearly added to a photo image. I mean, Arturo's already laughing about it already. But in fact, yeah, exactly. Here is the clip from ABC News of this back and forth between Donald Trump and reporter Terry Moran. So let's take a listen.
I can't have a trial, a major trial for every person that came in illegally. We have thousands of murderers that came in. They're going to murder people. They already have murdered people in our country.
Right, so
we have to get them out, and we have to get them out fast.
Really bad guys, but in our country, even bad guys get due process, right?
If people come into our country illegally, there's a different standard. These are illegal. They came in illegally.
But they get due process.
Well, they get a process where we have to get them out. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the Venezuelans.
They get whatever my lawyers say.
Those tattoos. Oh, you had some tattoos that are interpreted that way. But let's move on.
Wait a minute. Hey, Terry.
He did not Don't have the letter MS13.
It says MS13.
That was Photoshop.
That was Photoshop, Terry. You can't do that. Hey, they're giving you the big break of a lifetime. You know, you're doing the interview. I picked you because, frankly, I never heard of you, but that's okay.
I picked you, Terry.
But you're not being very nice.
The image were Photoshop. Okay, you can clearly see it on the clip. Anyone can go on YouTube and see the clip. And clearly, you know, the tattoos themselves have nothing to do with the letters MS13. So, again, Arturo, since we are in the middle of a place drive, I actually have two questions for you here. Let's tackle the first one here. And actually, I'm going to call out Terry Moran from ABC News, because you heard in there that he said, let's move on to something else. While Trump was essentially burying himself with this senile senior moment that he was having with the Photoshop image of Kinmar Abrego Garcia's hand. Okay. So look, this is the difference, a striking difference between mainstream media reporting and independent journalism. Because I don't know about you. I'm curious to know, Arturo, how would you handle this situation where the president, let alone anyone else in this administration, would say something profoundly inaccurate, let alone stupid, and you're not going to say, let's move on to something else. I mean, come on. I'm sorry, but we got to call Terry Moran out on this.
Right. You know, I would have had the image in my hand, you know, and I would have pointed right at the M, the S, the 1, and the 3, and be like, that part is Photoshopped. You know what I mean? How do you not know that? You know, they put that there to supposedly explain to the layman what these tattoos signify. They just made it up. I mean, I've never seen a tattoo like that. And, you know, I've followed the MS-13 story and all kinds of different, you know, 18th Street, a lot of gang stories. And I can't say I've ever seen that. So to think that a guy like Donald Trump thinks that the actual letters and the numbers were tattooed is just beyond me. Like, he must be senile. He must be just, you know, losing it, or maybe he can't see right. Maybe his vision's fried. I don't know, you know, but I can't explain how any person at any age could think that that was, those letters and numbers were tattooed. And I don't know who didn't explain this to him. You know, he kept bragging about it. And people all over social media are like, dude, that's Photoshop. That's Photoshop. Did his team not say, okay, these letters we put there to explain to people? You know, nobody explained that to Trump, that he's just going to go to this, never heard of you, Terry Moran. You know, Trump never heard of anybody. And it's just, it speaks to how in this society, and granted, I understand that it is Trump, and there is this little bit of a special exception there. But white people could say whatever the hell they want about black people and Latinos in the media or otherwise and just get away with it. Like when I called out CBS a year and a half ago because they let some dude on the street in New York start screaming about how migrants aren't being vetted, how they're just being let in, and the whole processing is just being ignored. And they never corrected him on that. They made it seem like what he's saying was true, and it's not. You know, there is medical screening. There is a process. It takes days. They have to get their backgrounds checked, blah, blah, blah. But they let that slide. And when it comes to these types of situations, particularly right now with the tattoos, you know, you mentioned this, I think, before we got on the air about what was that report I cited from the Washington Law Review, right? And they said that in their 2023 report, right?
Yes.
In the gang databases, right, 40% of gang members are white. But in New York, 99% of the people listed in their gang database are black and Latino.
That was according to the New York Police Department. Yes, go on.
Right. In the Chicago gang database, 96% are black or Latino. And in L.A., 98% are black or Latino. And remember, roughly 40% of all gang members in the U.S. are white, but they're not in that database. And that's because people like Trump, people in power, and cops, shady cops, will throw anybody who they feel like is a criminal into these databases. And I equate it to what police say, what police call test the lying. And that's lying in court to secure a conviction. And they do that because in their mind, they feel like the suspect, whatever he allegedly did, he should be in prison. So they will lie under oath. And this is something I've reported on a lot because it's a huge problem, the test-the-lying thing. And when it comes to Abrego Garcia, that's what happened there. A cop said, oh, yeah, he is Tren del Agua gang member. But that same cop got busted giving information to a sex worker, and he was later listed as a do not call, as in do not use as a witness in court because his testimony is unreliable. He's not trustworthy. The Trump administration is still hanging on to what this cop said about Kilmar Abrego Garcia as being a Tren del Agua gang member, despite the fact that his testimony was thrown out because he's an unreliable witness as a cop. And that's where you are with Trump and the MS-13. And like, he just thinks he can say whatever and get away with it. This is why, you know, I was talking to my stepdad about this earlier today, about Kilmar Abrego Garcia, that, you know, he's asking me how could they just pick him up off the street, send him to a prison in a foreign country, and I can't answer that question because it's not legal. He wasn't a criminal here. What justifies throwing him in a prison somewhere else? And that's the issue, because somebody said so. And instead of proving their case in court, they start talking about their evidence is privileged information, essentially classified, and you know, the judge isn't going for any of that, and they won't give him the due process because they know they won't win that case because they don't really have anything against him. And that's why they sent him to El Salvador.
Yeah, we did a whole show on that, and there's some issues with how that prison was built in the first place that deserves a one-hour conversation in and of itself. So let me paraphrase you here with regards to the information and the data that you just brought out, because this is in reference to your February article on tattoos, as you mentioned, and you sort of paraphrase the Washington Law Review from the 2023 report. So I'm quoting you here, quote, "Part of the report cites self-reported data, widely accepted among criminologists to be the most accurate. That indicates that roughly 40% of U.S. gang members are white. However, as you mentioned, 99% of those listed in the New York Police Department's gang database are reportedly Black and Latino. 96% of those listed in Chicago's gang database are Latino and Black. 98% of those who have been sentenced to prison with gang sentencing enhancements in L.A. County are people of color." And to point out perhaps an even more egregious example of this, in Mississippi, the Association of Gang Investigators reported that 53% of the gang members in the state are white. But everyone arrested under the state's gang law between 2010 and 2017 was Black. This is the type of reporting that Arturo Dominguez has done, and these are the type of reporters that we try to have on the Latino Media Collective every opportunity we get, but it's only possible with your financial support for independent media outlets like WPFW. So as I said before, we are in the middle of WPFW's Spring Place Drive. So if you want to continue to hear more fantastic voices, and perhaps more importantly, fantastic information like what Arturo has given us, make a donation to WPFWFM.org. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Like I said before earlier at the beginning of the show, and as Arturo has mentioned, that while migration has brought us to this conversation, the issue of criminalizing people based on tattoos affects all people of color in this country, whether citizen or non-citizen. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article in Substack is entitled "Court Docs, Street Clothes, Tattoos, and Dubious Claims of Gang Affiliation." This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
I'm slaving every day for my living, slaving so hard. I'm working every day in the coal mine, working so hard.
Was Lloyd Parks, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, reminding everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW's Spring Place Drive right now, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective at this hour with your financial support by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also go call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Again, the focus on today's show is the politics of tattoos and how it disproportionately criminalizes people of color in this country with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. And certainly the urgency that we would like to convey in this conversation, I know that there's certain parts here that we've laughed at, but again, innocent people are being deported, are being criminalized because of a flawed and deeply racist and xenophobic law enforcement system that is profiling people based on tattoos. The most absurd tattoos, as Arturo mentioned earlier, that you can imagine, whether it be a STAR, which would be ridiculous in the state of Texas, an AR-15, which seems to criminalize people of color, but not so much Caucasians, shall we say, the Crown, which with regards to Latin America, you know, can be conveyed to a lot of things that have nothing to do with gang activity whatsoever. We mentioned the clock tattoo, the image that ICE put out with regards to determining gang affiliation was actually identified by a British man, in other words, not Latino, in England, which is not in South America, to his own arm, which goes to show you the flimsy research, if you can even call it that, that ICE did to determine gang affiliation on migrants. So during the course of this narrative, and this sort of lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW, as the story of criminalizing people of color based on tattoos, Arturo, little to nothing has been mentioned about white nationalist tattoos being held to the same standard. What do you make of the media narrative omitting tattoos by white nationalists that are more direct in their meanings? And by direct, I just want to say this. There's nothing about Michael Jordan's tattoo that has anything to do whatsoever about gang affiliation. We've established that already. I don't know how you can even contort your own eyeballs to think that there's some sort of ambiguous thing behind that logo. A logo that's been around, oh, I don't know, 40 years now at this point, 40 plus years. But when it comes to tattoos from white nationalists, especially those from the January 6th insurrection, there is no ambiguity whatsoever. It's very direct what they want to do and what they intend to do and what they believe in their own tattoos. There's no ambiguity whatsoever, but I digress.
Well, you know, it's okay. For example, this is a pretty glaring example, is the Proud Boys. They use the giant P and the B. It's a big, huge tattoo, and it uses the exact same font as the MS-13 people, right? So you see a guy with a giant MS on his chest, okay, he's probably a gang member, right? Obviously, you know, you see a dude with a Proud Boys tattoo on his chest, he's a gang member. You know, you see Pete Hegseth with his, you know, tattoos, the Deuce Vault, the whole Crusader Cross, all these things, right? Those are gang tattoos, you know?
I was going to hold that separately because that is an example of Christian nationalism.
Big time.
Which is also a cause for concern. But the difference is that's not considered a threat to the United States, Christian nationalism.
Right, right. And then, you know, you have, there's a lot of them. There's, you know, the Three Percenters. There's the Oath Keepers. There's Active Club. There's the Patriot Prayer, Patriot Front. You know, all these hate groups, right? And, you know, the rise in white nationalism and the rise in like hate crimes and anti-Semitism absolutely go together, you know, but nobody wants to talk about these hate groups, right? Like, oh, what was the town when the neo-Nazis went to that community that was like 92% black and it was outside of St. Louis somewhere. And the black folks in that community came out, ran them off, got confrontational with them, got in their face. And those dudes ran back to their U-Haul and they had police protection. The Nazis had police protection, not the community. These outsiders who were waving Nazi flags had police protection. And when the people of the community came to confront them, the cops, that's when the cops started getting in people's face. He was getting in black people's face, not the Nazis' face. They were helping the Nazis get in their truck, helping the Nazis get away, gave them an escort to their cars. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You see the same thing. And all these Proud Boys rallies, you know, I reported on a few of these cases. A lot of other people did, where the Proud Boys were working with the cops in D.C., in Portland, in Seattle, in Baltimore, everywhere. So, you know, you see this night and day reaction to gangs, right? White gangs versus non-white gangs. The same thing goes with the cartels, right? You have your biker gangs. You have the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, which is national, right? Thousands of people. You have all kinds of these gangs and they're smuggling drugs into the United States, right? So you hear all these statistics about 90 something percent of US citizens are the smugglers, 98% of the time are US citizens. That's who that is. you don't hear our government calling them cartels. The Hell's Angels are international now, right? They're all over the world. They have a big, broad network of guns and drugs and all kinds of stuff. You never hear them being called a cartel. They're just a biker gang, despite the fact that they're an international criminal organization now. So you see it and you see the contrast. And if our government really wanted to attack the fentanyl issue, that's who they would take out. Because if the cartels south of the border don't have anybody to work with here, then you basically cut it off, right? But instead, they want to build up the military at the border. They want to threaten Mexico. They want to, you know, all these things. And it's provocative. And that's the point. They're trying to provoke these situations to try to prove they're right. Because during the whole campaign, it was about criminal migrant, criminal migrant, criminal migrant. But then now, there just aren't that many. You know, everybody knows that immigrants in this country commit far less crime than U.S. citizens, the native-born U.S. citizens. So when Donald Trump tried to make 15 million people look like criminals, and then when it came time to round them up, turns out they're not all criminals, they have to start inventing things to take them in. Like, for example, just recently, Homeland Security, they've done a few of these where they charge like 900 migrants on immigration-related crimes, right? Or that's what they say. But only fewer than half were actually immigration, you know, crossing the border type situation, which is a civil penalty, or more than half were just a civil penalty. So, like, they're criminalizing people with dubious claims of immigration-related crimes. That's what they keep calling it. And then this week, it was another 1,200 or something migrants that they just DOJ charged with immigration-related crimes, and that's because none of these people were criminals before. You know, they were here, protected status here, whatever, and they're trying to say that because they crossed the border to claim asylum, they broke the law, which they didn't. That's a legal way to claim asylum. But that's what they're doing. They can't find criminals, so they're making them criminals. And that's what they did with Abrego Garcia and a few other people. You know, with the Palestinian stuff and all that, they tried to criminalize them, calling them national security threats, Hamas supporters, all this nonsense.
Hamas supporters, national security threats. Yeah, you know what? That case of the med students over in Massachusetts who got snatched up and disappeared by ICE, disappeared, I'm using that word, by ICE in the middle of the street. I read her article, and I could tell you something. There's nothing in there that would even convey any threat to national security at all whatsoever. Your articles are much more fiery than what I read there. They were tame by comparison. But because of what they're defending, what they're trying to defend, what they're trying to speak out on, it's a threat to the policy that has clearly become profoundly unpopular nationwide. And so as a result of that, we're not only criminalizing med students, we're also criminalizing U.S.-born children who are 2, 4, 7 years old, one of which, the case last week of the child who has stage 4 cancer, those are people that are being criminalized and deported from the country. And so it's sickening. It's disgusting. It speaks volumes to the level of cowardice that this administration has. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to let Terry Moran off the hook here with that interview that we heard earlier from ABC News, because this is the frame of reference I have every time I do one of these shows with you. And in my opinion, I don't think Terry Moran has that frame of reference or has that sense of urgency in mind to just say, let's move on, while Trump is basically incriminating himself, or at the very least showing everyone his ignorance to the issue at hand. He's playing God with people's lives, and he's doing it with a profound frame of reference based on ignorance and xenophobia. And so, again, I want to convey this sense of urgency to the WPFW audience as we have this conversation, as we do this in the middle of the place drive, because if you want to continue to hear more compelling stories like these and have more fantastic guests like Arturo Dominguez on the show, please make a donation to WPFWFM.org. Make a call to 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. I was not joking around that people that look like myself and Arturo are now targets of any sort of law enforcement that on any whim, at any whim whatsoever, could just ask us, where are your papers? Where's your ID card? Do you have this documentation? What are you doing in this part of town? You know, this is the reality that we are facing, you know, not just myself and Arturo, but all people of color at this moment in time. Even as I had this conversation here in Washington, there were ICE raids in downtown Washington in various businesses, and they're specifically targeting places where they know that there are people of color working in those institutions. And so it's happening right now. It could be happening as we have this conversation, as this is being played on the WPFW airwaves right now. So again, your support for independent journalism is so important right now. And it's so important to get more voices like Arturo Dominguez on the show so we can have these conversations and be as blunt to the best of our ability, but informative at the same time as well as we carry out this conversation. Because let's hold Pete Hegseth into the fire here. Because look, we could count the number of white nationalist crimes, high-profile white nationalist crimes that have taken place in the U.S. I think you mentioned Ferguson near the St. Louis area. There's also Charlottesville. There's also the El Paso shooting, the January 6th insurrection. We could go on. And in one form or another, you could find people with tattoos in those cases, but they're not being held to the same standard or at the very least criminalized the same way people of color have been, Arturo. And in one form or another, there's some Christian nationalism behind some of those cases. And it should be at the very least concerning and troublesome and worrisome that Pete Hegseth, the current defense secretary, has a lot of tattoos that are construed as white nationalists. And even construed as being polite, because if you remember, you know, in the DEI purge of the Defense Department, a lot of books got banned in the military. Yeah. One that stayed was Mein Kampf. So yeah. What do you have to say about Pete Hegseth here?
Well, you know, he's essentially become the de facto leader of the Christian nationalist movement right now. He's, you know...
Him and Stephen Miller.
Yeah, where, you know, Stephen Miller, yeah, he's a bit of a different animal, but Pete Hegseth has kind of been elevated above that, above Stephen Miller. But Hegseth is always trying to push this whole warrior ethos about the military. You know, they talk about how recruitment is up. It's up because Christian nationalists are joining the military. It's pretty obvious to people who are paying attention to these explosion of hate groups. And, you know, I shifted my focus from the hate groups on the street to the people in the White House and the people in Congress, because they're the ones with the voice and the power and the money. And you have groups, not just the Heritage Foundation and America First and America First Legal, Stephen Miller's thing. You also have the Conservative Partnership Institute and all kinds of other stuff. So, yeah, we're in a very dangerous time. And I think that if you're not paying attention to who's in the White House and who's in Congress, you're going to be missing a big part of what's to come, because hate groups are going to be getting their cues from these people. Whether intentionally or not, we all know how dog whistles work. The person who is meant for understands what it means. And in some cases, those dog whistles get misconstrued and some dude goes, you know, a little haywire. But yeah, what we're facing now is a very big white Christian nationalist movement. When I started looking into the administration and how many Christian nationalists and racists and stuff like that are in the White House, it started to become pretty clear. And the more I started looking into it, the scarier it got, because you're talking about Hegseth, you're talking about Rubio putting in that Darren Beatty guy who was originally fired from the first Trump administration because he attended a white nationalist conference. Rubio willingly just hired this guy. That was his pick from the minute Rubio got the job. You have Kash Patel bringing in Dan Bongino. All these people, you know, you fired four-star generals that sat on the Joint Chiefs to make room for some guy who needs waivers to do the job, some white guy who has similar Christian nationalist views as Hegseth. And when you listen to Hegseth talk, and he says that the modern day right now is similar to the Crusades of thousands of years ago, war with the Muslims, war with the Arabs. And that's a scary thing. You know, I talk about his dangerous obsession with the border, and now you have that 4,500 soldiers on that striker brigade down there, and they don't need them. That's a fast response unit, infantry unit, the combat unit. They respond to anything anywhere in the world within 72 hours, 96 hours tops. Their response to Mexico, probably 12 hours, because they're there, they're ready. So, you know, recently Trump was trying to convince Sheinbaum to let the military into Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum into Mexico. She said, no way.
Not going to happen.
Right. So we're in a very precarious time, you know, with all these people in leadership positions. You have racists and white nationalists with more power than they've ever had. And it's a pretty scary time. Donald Trump is like intentionally blurring the lines between separation of powers between federal law enforcement and local and state. You know, that's technically unconstitutional, but we had the Immigration Reform Act under Bill Clinton that created the 287G program, which allows Customs and Border Patrol to deputize the local police to do federal law enforcement. Again, that should technically be unconstitutional, but it's been law now since 1996, I believe it is.
Yes. And
blurring that line is a very scary thing for our civil liberties. And it blows me away that these anti-government types on the Trump side are so willingly embracing this blurring of the lines. We have the U.S. military on U.S. soil, which is technically not allowed, but they're on U.S. soil at the border. They took over public lands to create a military zone. So if anybody crosses, the military can arrest them for trespassing on military property. That is an escalation against the people of the United States, citizen or not, non-citizen, doesn't matter. And what's it going to take for Donald Trump to slowly but surely, that military goes from the border to that buffer, 150-mile buffer zone that ICE has or that Border Patrol has. Next thing you know, you have military all over the street, you know, because in a state like Florida, that 150-mile buffer covers the whole state. Maine covers the whole state. There are a lot of states that are completely covered by that buffer, and Customs and Border Patrol has free rein all over the place. It's a really scary situation in that regard, because we have taken the biggest step towards a full-blown police state that we have since 9/11. This is a huge jump. Huge jump.
Profoundly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Profoundly. And this is precisely why I love having you on the show. And again, thank you for joining me and putting in this sense of urgency into this conversation as well, because it's interesting that you mentioned that you're more focused on the white nationalists at the top, because when we first started having you on the show, we were talking about the white nationalists on the street level, which just shows you how much they progress and how much this country has regressed when it comes to white nationalism profoundly. And as we have this conversation in the middle of the pledge drive here, I want to leave a few questions for the audience here to think about, because the whole narrative against migrants in this country under the current Trump administration has been this perception of war, that they're waging a war against criminal migrants. If that were the case, we would be hearing about shootouts between migrants and ICE agents every day. That is not the case at all. As I said before, we are deporting U.S. citizens as young as 2 years old right now in this quote-unquote war on migrants. A lot of the videos that have gone viral, whether it be on YouTube or on TikTok, has been ICE aggressively going after migrants. There's that video in Massachusetts of ICE agents breaking down a car window with an axe to get somebody that was essentially the wrong person that they were going after. And of course, the disappearances of students who have spoken out for Palestinian rights. I mean, if this is a war, then there's only one side that's committing the atrocities, the violence, and the criminality of this whole scheme that is being waged right now. And with regards to the Sakhalin prison, And this lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW and the Latino Media Collective. With regards to the case of Kinmal Abrego Garcia, I want to let the WPFW audience know that even if Kinmal Abrego Garcia were to come back to the U.S. tomorrow, we still have serious questions to address about sending migrants to a torture prison in El Salvador. And do we even care about the Salvadorans who are in that prison as well under an illegal presidency that has the full 100% support of the Trump administration right now? Will we care tomorrow if Kinmal Abrego Garcia were to come back today? And I will tell you, the WPFW audience, that as long as the Latino Media Collective is on WPFW on the airwaves, we will definitely care about it, we will definitely cover it, and we will definitely expand upon it so long as this lack of social justice continues in places like El Salvador. So again, this lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW. So again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. Our goal at this hour is $500. It goes a long way to the long-term sustainability of both the Latino Media Collective and WPFW. You can also make a call to 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, so we can continue to have fantastic guests like Arturo Dominguez on the show. He's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article in Substack is entitled Court Docs, Street Clothes, Tattoos, and Dubious Claims of Gang Affiliation. And as always, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. Arturo, keep following the story. Keep up the great work. And we're happy to have you on again on the show. So thanks again.
No, man. Yeah, I appreciate it. I just wanted to mention real quick, I know we're talking about all these kids and stuff related to immigration. There's one case that keeps getting overlooked, and that's because this child isn't a U.S. citizen, but her parents got deported to Venezuela. Christine Ohm allegedly says that they were members of Tren del Agua, and as they were getting deported, DHS took the child from them. So the child is still here in HHS custody. The parents are back in Venezuela. So that's a story that keeps getting overlooked, and I find it a little frustrating, but I just thought it was worth mentioning because it really eats at me. It's been killing me.
Man, all the more reason to have you back on the show. So keep following it, and we should definitely expand on it the next time you're on the show. So thanks again for being on the show with us. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. But for right now, support WPFW during the Spring Plates Drive by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also go to 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. With that said, that is it for today's show. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening and supporting the Latino Media Collective. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
Pacifica Radio. I'm Christina Onnestad. President Donald Trump is backtracking off his $4.5 trillion tax cut plan for the wealthy, and in an about-face wrote on social media he'd support a tax on the rich. Quote, "The problem with even a tiny tax increase for the rich, which I and all others would graciously accept in order to help the lower and middle-income workers, is the radical left Democrat lunatics would go around screaming, 'Read my lips,'" unquote. He went on to write, "Republicans should probably not do it, but I'm okay if they do." Media reports say Trump has floated the idea of raising taxes on those who make $2.5 million or more each year. The sudden about-face comes amidst mounting opposition to his current tax plan, which Republicans are pursuing. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says their proposals would result in millions of Americans losing health insurance due to cuts to Medicaid to offset lost revenue from tax cuts. The groups Mom Rising and other social service providers staged a 24-hour vigil against proposed cuts on the Capitol that wrapped up Thursday, with people reading testimonies of the impacts on the most vulnerable. Here's some of them.
Jennifer, I have a 22-year-old son with autism. He would no longer be able to live independently or receive the level of direct service provider supports that he requires.
Allie from New Bern, North Carolina. As a pediatric hospice nurse, children I care for on Medicaid are the only ones who are consistently able to receive life-prolonging treatments.
Medicaid gives her that ability to be part of her school community and gives schools the ability to support children like Vivian with disabilities so they can learn.
Thursday, Democrats also spoke out against the cuts. Moderate Republicans are now voicing skepticism of the plan as well. Israel's relentless bombing of Gaza continues, with more than a dozen Palestinians killed today. A new group of American security contractors, ex-military officers, and humanitarian aid officials are proposing to take over the distribution of food and other supplies in Gaza based on plans similar to ones designed by Israel. The United Nations and aid groups have rejected Israel's moves to control aid distribution. It staged a blockade of aid and food from entering Gaza, now in its third month. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders blasted the blockade Thursday, speaking on the Senate floor, calling it a war crime.
Starving children to death as a weapon of war is a clear violation of the Geneva Convention, the Foreign Assistance Act, and basic human decency. Civilized people do not starve children to death. What is going on right now in Gaza is a war crime.
As Rami Amagari reports from Gaza, nearly 50 children have starved to death since Israel's blockade.
Hospitals are seeing dozens of cases of child malnutrition daily. Dr. Raghib Elara is the chief of malnutrition in the digestive system department at the Aaron Tisi Pediatrics Hospital in Gaza City.
The cases we follow up here at the Aaron Tisi Hospital are those in the early years of life. They all suffer from severe shortage of immunity and weight. In many cases, we receive children with severe infections due to malnutrition. Sometimes the children are dying from malnutrition.
Food supplies continue to dwindle. For Pacifica Radio, I am Rami Elmirari in Gaza.
Indian and Pakistani soldiers have exchanged heavy volleys of shells and gunfire across their frontier in Kashmir, killing at least five civilians in a growing military standoff. The first U.S.-born Pope Leo XIV says his election is both a cross to bear and a blessing as he celebrates his first Mass as the head of the Catholic Church in its more than